I'm Olivia May, here with my teacher, friend, and boss, Katrina Chester, as we press record at work in our studio. Welcome to Imprecise Storytelling. On an average day at work, so many teachings show us how limiting the stories of ourselves are. Are we more or less than our stories? What if beliefs cloud what is? Does it stop the curiosity to explore? If you think you know everything, you might be your own imprecise storyteller. We last left off talking about the roles we play in life, so let's begin part two.
Because when I am setting out to get enlightened, I'm so far away from it that I couldn't even spit and touch it.
When you're searching for it is when you can't find it.
Yeah, you know that. And I mean, you listening, people out there listening know that you try too hard, you know, and you know that saying, girls say it. I don't know if boys say it, but girls always say, the minute I stopped looking for a boyfriend, this guy showed up. The minute I stopped being scared of this, I never had to go to the dentist again or whatever it is. I never needed another root canal.
Mine was this, the minute I wanted to no longer be in love or have love, a relationship, all of that, is the minute I found the person I want to be with for the rest of my life.
Right.
And I see that as the shedding of what my belief of love meant.
So I guess it almost takes for you to give up, right?
Oh, I'm a strong believer in giving up. I give up every day. Everything I do, I give up. Because the minute I give up is when things happen right.
But say it the other way now so people can understand what we're not saying.
Say it the other way. I give up my belief of what I'm trying to do. I give up. I shed what I think is truth that truly isn't. It's my inconsistent story about whatever I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then the floodgates just...
That's still really open, though.
And come in.
I'm asking you to deliver I give up in a way that is fueled from frustration, fear, anger, and control.
The words come to mind as I'm letting go of trying.
So, imagine this. So, Olivia just said, I give up every day. You know, and you hear the sense of that. It almost feels like, right? Like I even am feeling better from hearing you say that. And then hear this. I'm done. Oh. I am so done. I am never dating anybody again.
There's a lot of energy in that.
I'm finished with that person, with that job, with that concept, with that belief. I'm done. Yeah. I'm over it. Okay, so that is a different kind of, that's a blocking.
That is a blocking.
So you're blocking.
Because it's a new belief.
Because it's a new belief, yeah. You're just throwing out one thing to gather another. And it feels safer at the moment. You know, for me, it feels so safe at the moment. Yeah, I feel like, all right, well, now I'm done with that. I'm so done with that. Even people that are grieving, you know, the death of somebody, I can feel them pushing their subconscious to, or their conscious, whatever, I don't know which it is in them, by using words like, I'm going to be done with this soon, or I've had enough of this grieving, feeling bad, feeling sorry for myself bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, it's just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, really, right? Is that the right term? What am I trying to say? You're just exchanging one role and model for another. That's what I'm trying to say.
And it's maybe even the exact opposite of the spectrum, you know? So here I am on this side, and now I'm exactly to the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I mean, it sounds horrible what we're asking, because we're saying it sounds very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It sounds like my heart just got broken. And what they're talking about is me not being pissed off and wanting to shut my heart off because I can't take this pain anymore.
Yeah.
And so then I think it gets into this realm of when you, there's a difference in our culture, in today's world. I don't even think it's just our culture as in America. I just think the human condition, we've evolved a bit out of the naturalness of feeling.
Yeah.
When I can feel the difference for me in reporting that I'm in danger of being hurt emotionally, and then the solution is to shut off emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what that's void of is the direct experience with what feeling, quote unquote, hurt. Not to denigrate by putting the quotes around it, but to highlight what does feeling hurt feel like inside.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're all reporters, you know? We're all, like, on Channel 7
mm-hmm.
reporting, this is happening and this is happening. And, well, how are you? Are you happy? Yes, I'm very happy. Everything's great. Everything sucks. And I think the work that we do is so challenging because it's asking us to be with that feeling of hurt or happiness. But, like, what does it feel like? Because when we just stay as the person reporting it, and I'm not trying to compare that to the witness at all. I'm just, it's for lack of a word right now, I don't really mean to say reporting, but I mean an external reporting that feels very much the same as our inner dialogue. How are you doing today? I feel tired. I am tired. All of these things feel like they're happening to us. But to sort of move into the territory of this is a happening, it's a happening, it creates some space for us to actually say, you know what, I need to go feel this.
Yeah.
Because I feel my mind protecting me. I feel my mind protecting me when my heart gets hurt, when my feelings get hurt, when I am scared. I immediately feel that the insides of me are like, she can't deal, so just report on it. Just tell her what she's feeling,
right,
rather than creating the space to feel it. And I find that I meet with that also when I need to meditate or I need to practice. When I use that part of me, my mind almost feels like it's protecting me by saying, but I don't feel like it, or, but first let me watch this, or first let me do this, or, you know, I'm really hungry, I'll do it after I eat. And then what happens? Bam. We report that we're lazy, mm-hmm. that we're unmotivated, or that the philosophy or the yoga or the Tai Chi or the ballet or the therapy doesn't work. Like, it's always here, you know, in one spot, and then it lashes out.
Yeah.
And that's how you can tell that it's not spacious enough to actually feel. And when you ask people, what does it feel like in your body to feel sadness? I mean, that you're like asking me to find the pink elephant floating around the sky that doesn't even exist. Like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
It feels so unfamiliar because we haven't cultivated that.
Yeah.
But it's never as bad. When you get in there and you say, okay, not with, all right, that's it, I'm going to face this sadness. That's not a really great approach. I don't know if that'll work for you. Try whatever you need to try. But I learned to soften what I say out loud, and then it helps me soften what I say inside. And I've also done it the other way.
I am. This all feels relevant to a younger me when I was the first, like, what you're telling me is something I learned for the first time from my English teacher.
Hmm.
Because she saw me in my obsessive compulsive exercising, which then led to, was already wrapped in with anorexia and bulimia through high school. And when you're so wrapped up in it, you're just on go mode. So I created a confined box for me to live in, and that meant I woke up and I ran a mile. It meant after I ran that mile, I don't eat. It meant going to school, and at lunch I was running the track. And I fought myself when I was hungry. I hated that I had to be hungry. It just, you know, my belief was obviously if I eat, I gain weight. And I wanted control. I knew that it took a while for me to realize that the eating disorders were control-based. I wanted so much control. I wanted to be in control of something like my life. And the only thing I could control was what went in or out of my mouth.
Mm.
And so I'm running out the track, and she would at first create the space from the what I wanted to do and doing it by interjecting in my life in that moment, like, hi, you know, sort of break me out of the she's seeing me go to the track, but her class was right before that, so pop in, kind of walk over. And it changed through the year, like it got more and more where I eventually, instead of going to the track, I came to the class, we would sit and talk. To probably a few months of that, it finally became actually talking about what I wanted to do. I wanted to go throw up right now. Okay, let's sit here. What does it feel like? What does that mean? Can you go a second longer? Can we go a day without it? Like, it all took this time of she had to force me to create some space so that my obsessive decision to live in this box and do this and go, go, go would stop for a little bit, because I obviously couldn't make myself stop. I didn't want to make myself stop. And it created a lot of turmoil. And here I am now. Someone knows that I'm doing this. And I pushed, pushed, pushed. But that was the ultimate freedom that was given to me. And I just remember that being a huge thing and creating the space, sit with the feeling. I hated feelings. My feelings came out of my mouth with food, you know? Like, I wanted them to physically leave. And that's what I needed to do to feel in control. Actually, purge.
Wow.
It's...
What did it feel like?
It felt... I mean, it was always an uncomfortable, upset stomach. It felt like a, you know, 2-month-old crying in a crib.
Mm.
You know, and it's just extreme discomfort with myself. I think I physically hated the feeling of a body. I'm just this internal, like, soul that sort of hated being a human. And I can see parts of that still existing in my life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What an opportunity.
Yeah.
That teacher, you know, came.
Saw.
And, yeah. And what a great way she did it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She just titrated. Slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you faced those feelings, I don't know if it's this way for you, but the story of the feelings was so much bigger and lasted so much longer than the actual facing of it.
Yep.
Like, once I got in there, a great teacher, Reggie Ray, Vajrayana Buddhism, he does amazing work in somatic practices. He's in Colorado. And he says, you know, he says it really eloquently, that when you get in and you feel it and you face it, it's nothing like the mind's facing of it. Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, just close your eyes, follow the very first thing in your body that you can identify with. It might be your pinky toe, it could be your ribs, it could be your stomach, it could be your eye. There's nobody to say where it should be. Mm-hmm. Just gravitate towards the place inside of you that might need attention. Oh, who's calling? Who's calling? And it might be your big toe. And you just bring your awareness, your attention, your presence to that area and just see what happens. That's it. I'm not thinking that any fireworks are going to go off. And, mm-hmm. But after enough times of just saying, I don't know everything, why don't I just try? Just enough times of saying, can you even conceive mm-hmm. that there's something there? As Reggie Ray says, when you get there, something that once felt so weighted and heavy and solid, you may find is transparent. And you can float right through it. To experience that is the only way to explain. Because there's no words to really explain it. And if there are people way better than me to describe it. Mm-hmm. The story, you know, meaning everybody out there and Olivia and I, the story is so much worse than the actual action, mm-hmm. than the actual task. Even the stories of why you were doing that, or, you know, they build up because they're covered with the reports of mm-hmm. what we're doing. So when I go in there, it sometimes could take a minute, it could take 3 years, who knows? Yeah. But it's just the curiosity that'll get you there. If you're not curious, you're just not ready and you're not there, and that's okay too. Yeah. The worst thing you could do is try to push it. But, you know, once something's solid and you face it and it's transparent and I can float right through it, and then it slowly, for me, I have a really visual mind, so things, descriptions like that help me. Mm-hmm. And I see it sort of disintegrate. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that the addiction or the aversion is gone? I have no idea. What got me in that mess in particular is thinking that I can control.
Yeah.
So why am I going to go inside the body and try to control? Mm-hmm. So it's like this softening place to see what occurs, like be curious and see what occurs. And I don't know if you experienced that. It might come, it might be in the later years after you had been through this, yeah. that you can look back and say, I cannot believe that that happened, or it feels like a different life.
Yeah.
And to me, those are all signs of a somatic adventure.
Yeah.
And that it couldn't have been nearly as bad as the mind was telling you, because the mind was telling you it's happening to you, and worse, you're making it happen.
Oh, absolutely. But I remember a very distinct young Olivia wanting that eating disorder. It meant something. It meant that I was strong. That I was powerful. That I had a strong will. I could withstand extreme amounts of hunger and pain. Like, I remember that vividly. And so I willed it into action. What's funny is that I liked it being private. I liked having it quiet. I mm-hmm. liked it. It was my thing. It was my little best friend. Mm. And when it got exposed, that sort of was a whole nother trauma, because now I had to let it go and I had to find a new one.
Oh, I know that feeling.
I had to find a new one.
Right.
And that just went to cutting. Yeah. Like, I was obsessed with seeing how much I could hurt myself.
Like a badge of honor sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure a lot of people can identify with that.
Made me feel more important, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was more interesting. I thought it was, like, dynamic, you know? I sort of was the girl you went on a first date with and she told you everything that was fucked up about herself.
Right. Yeah.
And just to see what the reaction would be and...
Because you're trying to find a reaction in you.
Yeah. And probably just to prove how much more powerful I am over, you know.
Well, the funny thing is that you are really powerful. Like, we all are really powerful.
Yes. So we can be powerful and damaging.
That's right.
We can be powerful and positive.
Or you could just be powerful.
Yeah. That's right. We don't have to have a label to power.
Yeah. We could just be really powerful and find it interesting when that power is used in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of it is that I can also hear, however appalling this might be to hear, but I can also hear how powerful it is to be able to do those things.
Yeah.
Because I sure as hell don't have that kind of power. Now I'm leaving out the labels of good or bad just for the point of it. Obviously we know we don't want to create that kind of violence,
mm-hmm.
but here we are talking about it. So it takes a lot of power to that, you know, how is that different really than a warrior that is training by going into the woods, you know, and fighting beasts and like all the movies and the stories and history of warrior training. So it's not like the mind is trying to separate you from and tell you you're, you know, fucked up. And that you're not powerful, so you need to try to get powerful by proving the power.
Mm-hmm.
And in that act, there's a separation between you and everybody else, which is really personified in that it was your secret with the self. Like, it was your special thing. No matter how screwed up or not screwed up or whatever there is in that, it's loaded. It was yours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's separating, right? Mm-hmm. That's us and them. Nobody will understand me.
Mm-hmm.
Like depression and all that. All that sort of stuff, it's like whatever somebody's doing, if you're wondering whether it's harmful or not, how is it separating you from other people? Is it separating you in bad or good?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as Ram Dass always says, we feel very special in our specialness, you know, like here I am special, dysfunctional, but it's special in, you know, addictions or self-loathing or whatever. Mm-hmm. It just makes us go into a certain area of life where it's unacceptable. And even in that can feel powerful. On the other side of it, the really powerful thing is also being really kind to yourself.
Yeah.
That is really hard.
Yeah.
So which path do we want, really? It's an individual path. Do you want the path of, I want to show how much power I have and how much I can suffer through? Guess what? You don't need to cut or throw up or shoot heroin or get angry and punch a hole through the wall. Just your God-given life.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you're here being asked to wake up every day and do all of these things and fit into all of these roles and all of these models and be good and be bad. And all that alone is all the power. Like, if we could do that, that's so challenging.
Yeah.
And you could see that on that level too, yeah?
Yeah.
But it's so amazing how the mind when it wants power, will go to violence.
Yeah.
I heard this great line by Frank Ostesky. He's a really great teacher. I really enjoy his work. That violence is, we're creating violence on ourselves and others when we don't know what else to do with our suffering. Wow, that yeah. really is, again, another shift, like we talked about when yeah. we first started. Insufficient story, whatever, imprecise storytelling. Mm-hmm. Shifts it from lying. If somebody creates violence on me, immediately my mind wants to go to they're this, they're that, they're this, they're that.
Label.
And mm-hmm. if I could just pause for a minute and be with me, I would report, I feel hurt. Mm-hmm. I feel sad. Do you see that that's more powerful? Yep. Like, that's actually more powerful. You know how you know? Because it's hard to do. What's easy to do? You're an asshole. You're this. You're that. That's not the friend I kind of want. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. so easy. Yeah. It's so easy to go out here and blame everybody else. A really warrior practice is in being able to sit with that really, I feel hurt. I'm hurt or there's hurt, you know, and getting rid of the self-identification of it, of the, you know, there's hurt, there's sadness, there's rejection, and there's all the roles and models that come with being rejected and being sad, like thinking that it's weak. Some of the most incredible, incredible men that I know are men that cry. Mm-hmm. Tough, tough. Dudes, okay? Mm-hmm. Guys that have served time in prison and, you know, done things that maybe the outside world would say, wow, that's a really tough guy. Yeah. But what's really tough for them is feeling. Really feeling. And you can do that by starting to notice the reporting. Like, there's anger. And because anything other than that is going to be self-violent. And I soften when I look at people saying mean things. Okay, I'm not saying they're saying mean things to me, because that's all about me then, and I'm not seeing the practice in it. But when somebody says something mean to me, when I can pause and look at it through the lens of, that's just something that they're, that's an energy that they're not sure what to do with. Mm-hmm. That's a violence in them or a suffering in them that they're confused and they don't know where to direct it. And that's every single one of us. And I react differently to them. And I react differently to myself. When I'm mean, when I'm angry or whatever it is, and I create suffering on myself, it's so interesting to say to have my Katrina 2, my mind, say to my Katrina 1, being very mindful of the words I choose. There's violence and an energy of that violence that you're confused. You don't know where to put that energy, so you're directing it at yourself. And then you're directing it out. I mean, that's why they always say you have to be the change in the world that you want to see. Because mm-hmm. it's infecting. It's infecting. Mm-hmm. If you're around somebody that's practicing, stop looking for perfection in them. Mm-hmm. Because that's setting up the story that practice is about being perfect. And if that's the case, then that means perfect exists.
Right.
And that means you're going to try to get to it.
Yeah.
And the only indication you might have is by making fun of the people that are practicing or religious or whatever it might be. That making fun of them that's that opportunity for the noticing inside to say, well, what is it that I'm feeling that is making me have to create violence on somebody else? Because who in the world likes to be made fun of? I mean, yes, we can all be laughing at ourselves. My God, if I didn't know how to do that, I couldn't be here. I use so much comedy, and I find it hysterical all the time what my two is reporting. Yeah. But it's different because you don't know how somebody's showing up. And if somebody's showing up with a storyline that they're, you know, lacking in this one department, and then you happen to trigger that one department, it's almost part of our human, you know, mind to find that trigger, store it, and then use it at will. And you know those people, usually in your family, that know exactly what zinger to throw at you. But it really says more about them.
Yeah.
And you say more about you.
Yeah.
And I love when he allowed me to shift the perception of violence, like when you're speaking about bulimia and cutting and that those times in your life, how that it changes shape in my head when I see that as energy that most teenagers, not that they're cutting or doing bulimia, but I mean, we're all doing that in, I want a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I want love. Mm-hmm. I want to live here. It's going to be better.
The searching.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that searching is acting like we're not, it's not great where it is. Yep. It's going to take something else, one more thing. You know, in our society, there's those levels of violence. You know, it's way worse to kill somebody than it is to have bulimia.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you can also look at it as well from violence is violence. Yep. And when we stop creating it, or I won't even say that. I'm going to take that back. When we learn to be aware and notice the violence that we're creating on ourselves and the ones we're creating on others, like you have through bulimia and through cutting, that's when we can learn to redirect that energy.
Mm-hmm.
Just having that opening of, I might not be right. There is a little space for me to redefine that my kid is a brat, that I hate my life, that I hate my job, that I'm fat, that I'm old, that I'm too young, that I'm not tall enough. Just create the space that somewhere in the world, that might not be true. And if that could be there and there could be a curiosity for you to expand on that, then there is a whole world that opens up of how to redirect this stuck energy that has been executed through violence on yourself and on others. It's a daily practice. I mean, please, I will be doing this God knows how long. I mean, at least this lifetime I know, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what comes after this. And anybody that says they do is living in a fantasy world. And I have no idea. I just want to be with what is. And I don't find it as easy to be with what is when I feel that what is I. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
What a great sharing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thank you so much for telling us.
No, thank you for, you know, all you do for me. I mean, you're the one creating a space of comfortability, you know, to share.
Well, it's easy to do with somebody that is wanting that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it takes that's the curiosity. Wanting, I think, can even be the curiosity.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm learning to use words differently. I haven't figured this one out completely yet, but the Buddhism has a great teaching of the two arrows. And I just recently heard a teacher say it just so, so perfect. That the first arrow is the circumstance. It's whatever is. Mm-hmm. You could be fat. Mm-hmm. You could be skinny. Somebody could have passed away. Somebody eventually will pass away. So it's the actual fact of what we're dealing with in this human life. And if that's not enough, the second arrow comes. And the second arrow is fueled by the roles and the models, and really is a great way to see how hard it is for us to be with what is. So it's our clinging to anything other than what is actually in front of us. And it says that the controlling, the grasping, is the second arrow. And through that, I am creating violence. We're all creating violence, right? Because no matter how much dialogue we have on it, it's the first arrow is just there. It's there because we're human. The first arrow is the circumstance of being alive. So where are we when the second arrow hits? And they call it, what is leading us away from home? And the second arrow is away from home. What's leading me away from home in a moment could be longing for it to be a different way. For me to be this when I'm not. For that person to not break up with me. Mm-hmm. For that person to not pass away. The opportunity is that the wanting, which is what brought this up, that word, the wanting is what can stop us from shedding into the back into the first arrow to be with the circumstance. What's it like? What's it feel like? Rather than following some sort of program that somebody else has written, of the friend, of the sister that you knew whose husband died, and then these are the five stages of grief. And then you literally are willing these five stages of grief. How do you know that you didn't just or couldn't create two stages of grief? Mm-hmm. Just because somebody said, these are the five stages of grief, and now you're so busy identifying those five stages in yourself that there's no more room for us to create anything new. You may be going through the five stages. But what is actually present? What's in front of us? And you find all these incredible things that you never even knew existed because we're following these roles and these models. Even yoga. When you first get into yoga in this country in particular, you know, you're taught the eight limbs of yoga. And so then the whole thing becomes about moving from one limb to another, to another, to another, to another. All may be completely different for every person. Now, you know, yes, I'm not saying don't study those things. I'm saying study all of it. I'm saying, is there also simultaneously underneath you what is actually present? Because if it's not, if there's not something else simultaneously going on all the time, you're going to beat the shit out of yourself when you're not successful in limb two or the fourth step of grieving. And the belief that we have that the only way to motivate ourselves is to annihilate ourselves with internal dialogue just cannot be true. It cannot be true. That motivation only comes through beating the shit out of myself until I am so sick and tired of this. That's it. Tomorrow I'm joining a gym, or tomorrow I'm getting therapy, or because it's still something that feels out of my control. I say, get the therapy, get to the gym, do all of it, and simultaneously also cultivate that part in ourself that is spacious and learning that everything that comes to us, it does have a teacher. You know, and to have an outside teacher, if you could be so lucky as I have been with my outside external teacher, they are just grooming the interior teacher, mm-hmm, inside yourself. So, I just want to read something and then we're going to wrap it up because this is just such a great topic, though, Liv.
We might have to revisit it continuously.
I think we do, actually. I think we do need to revisit
it. It could almost be a little bit of a...
A series.
A series. Because it feels like we've had these talks before and they're really impromptu and they just sort of happen to me and you. And we've always said that we should just turn the microphone on.
Yes, yes.
Because you're teaching me in this moment, and I'm sharing, and you're teaching me,
absolutely, without a doubt.
So, I know people, I take so much from it. I can only imagine that other people kind of being able to, you know, like through this podcast and this episode, glean something from it. We could keep doing more and more of this.
Yeah, I think we should call this series Kicking the Shit Out of Ourselves series. The many ways in which we kick the shit out of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, I really... this is a practice because the perception of being a yogi or being a spiritual seeker, or if you don't like that word, whatever word you like, is that there is this ending place that you get to, and at that ending place is perfection. And I really think that that stops people from practicing, and it would stop me from practicing.
It's daunting.
It's absolutely insurmountable.
You feel like you have so far to go to get there, so why even begin?
That's right. And I've found the exact opposite is true, that being on these podcasts is really saying, I am not perfect. I am showing up in glorious imperfections, willing to be seen, because that's the willingness of myself wanting to see the self. It's not because I need to be seen. It's because I feel that people are a lot smarter than we think. And the dialogues that are going on in these platforms can sometimes feel like you're tuning in to listen to somebody talk about how wise they are or how much they've figured out. And the whole time that I'm sharing, whether the mic is on or not, simultaneously I'm in there cultivating this space in myself to be able to, with a sense of humor, feel what's separating me and what's bringing me peace and going to bring. And it's always that stuff that's bringing me peace that's affecting other people, because I can feel that and other people can feel that. And when you are trying to, you got to learn how to call yourself on your own shit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be out loud on the mic. Just because I'm not sitting here going, that was bullshit, Katrina.
Yeah.
There's a faith that happens when you're in practice with people in a satsang, in a sangha, where I know that you're doing the work underneath or on top of whatever direction you want to look at it in. Otherwise, I wouldn't feel the way that I do. Because I'm doing that.
Yeah.
We're all our own worst critic. But it's not a critique. It shifts from critique to, interesting.
Observer.
Yeah, cultivating the witness.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Morrison, right?
Hey.
Powerful dude. He says, the most important kind of freedom is to be what you really are. You trade in your reality for a role. You trade in your sense for an act. You give up your ability to feel and in exchange put on a mask. There can't be any large-scale revolution until there's a personal revolution on an individual level. It's got to happen inside first. Jim Morrison, The Doors. Check him out if you're really young and you're like, what's a door? Google it. What's The Doors? Jim Morrison was a poet and a philosopher, as many of those artists from that era were. Mm-hmm. All trying to tell us different ways of saying the unsayable. Is that a word? Unsayable. You can't speak about this sort of stuff. It's really hard. Try to tell somebody what it feels like to love your child. Try to tell somebody what it feels like inside of yourself when you feel really good. You'll find that what you'll say is, I don't know, I just feel great. Or, I don't know, I just love them so much, I just want to bite their head off. You know, we all go to those places of language and we fluff off that, guess what? It's really hard. And there are teachers out there like Ram Dass who just is eloquent and using his personality and the ego mind in a way to relate to us all so that the guards go down in the ego mind a little bit. And we're like, all right, this guy speaks our language. And, you know, I imagine someday when I'll be in that place, when I'll be in that place where it's just, nobody's expecting perfection. Everybody's just, you're actually accredited and given gold stars and millions of dollars, not for winning a sport or for inventing something, but for really, truly being vulnerable. Even with the shame and with the fear, like just, hey, are you vulnerable? I'm vulnerable. Cool. Let's have a conversation. And that's looked at as being really powerful. Very similar to what you just did, Liv.
Yeah.
Coming out and being able to say that to people. That's power.
Yeah.
That is power. And that inspires me, and I would imagine it's going to inspire everybody else. Mary Oliver. She says, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees and the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Wow. Love it. You don't have to be good. That's a really big message.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can all see the ways in which we are selling ourselves short in our imprecise storytelling, our inconsistent storytelling of who we think we are. Next time we want to tell somebody, oh, well, I always do that. Well, I've been doing that since I'm blah, blah, blah. Oh, I love this. I love that. Just notice that voice inside and even just feel the softening and saying, that's imprecise storytelling. It doesn't matter if it is or it isn't. And then use it externally if somebody lies to you. Couldn't it be they were just imprecise in their storytelling? What's it going to give you by believing they're a liar? You want to protect yourself? That's how you actually protect yourself, is by saying we are all imprecise storytellers. Because if we all knew what it was, we wouldn't be busy describing what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows what life is or death is or birth. We didn't choose all these things. And the illusion is that we have. So to allow a softness, just play with words like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Olivia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to everybody out there, we'll be back. We seem to be turning up all the time now, Zooming in the Lens podcast. And we are going to do a new group where we get to study a Hindu text called the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God, and use interpretations of it to find the roadmap to current day life. It's just interesting. It's a way for us to sit around online with a very close group of people that's small and find teachings that are relevant for today in very ancient scriptures. And if the word scripture is too heavy for you, just think teachings. And the Gita has always been my favorite. It was the first, and hopefully it will be the last when I get there. So Olivia and I are trying to put together an online course with Zooming in the Lens. For you to be a part of that, just go to functionalyogaonline.com and you can read about what Zooming in the Lens online course is, and we'll have the dialogue about the Gita practice coming up real soon. And may all of you be filled with peace and curiosity. Thanks for joining us.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix, mixforpix.com.